Hi everyone, welcome to the Stageless Podcast featuring Liam Gallagher's drummer Dan McDougall, who paints a really interesting picture of what it's like being the first person to collaborate with Liam Gallagher on the demos for As You Were, an album that has not only gone platinum but has seen a real meteoric rise back to the top where he belongs, headlining huge festivals and huge international shows. And he talks in detail, Dan, about him and Liam's unique relationship, the early rehearsals and songs rehearsed but not yet played, and loads more that's not been discussed before. It's great fun, I'm sure you'll learn lots. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry. Whilst all the arts funding has been ripped out, particularly in the UK, this podcast, I guess, exists to kind of help fill that gap. It's pass on the wisdom of some of these people who've worked with incredible musicians to help the next generation come through. For other Gallagher related episodes, we've had Gem Archer give his first in-depth interview, 90 minutes worth, in 5 years after having a traumatic brain injury, and he details that. He details his time in Oasis, writing songs with the Gallagher brothers, and through to now joining the High Flying Birds. We've also had Russ Pritchard, Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, on as well. We still get amazing feedback on that, like almost daily people send messages about how much they enjoy that episode, and we recorded that in Rome when they were touring supporting U2. Mikey Rowe, keyboardist in Oasis, now in High Flying Birds too, loads of classic stories from back in the day, and a reflective Paul Gallagher, in depth on sharing bedrooms with Noel and Liam growing up, and seeing them become household names. So you can find out more about that and listen to those at stageleftpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at the StageLeftPod. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/StageLeftPodcast. We have a load of behind the scenes photos on our Instagram page, including a great one of Dan, myself, and Christian, Liam's keyboardist, after the show the other week, where I look a bit half cut, which is standard what you'd expect after going drinking after a Liam Gallagher gig, I guess. On the website and etc., you'll also find episodes with Tony Visconti on producing David Bowie's final album Black Star, the hugely critically acclaimed comedian Stuart Lee on how his creative processes have been influenced by free jazz musicians, Wolfgang Flöhr of Kraftwerk on the moment the first electronic drum machine was created, Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses on what it's like touring with Slash and Axl Rose, Billy Burnett on a decade, crazy decade in Fleetwood Mac, and Lawrence Juber on getting bass tips from Paul McCartney when he was in Wings, and loads more episodes. Apologies about my voice in this interview, and I lost my voice the night before drinking Caipirinhas in Manchester Bar in Barcelona. There are a number of people who listened to previous episodes, so it was great to meet you all. The result is I do sound like a six-year-old having taken helium and then trying to do an impersonation of Marlon Brando in The Godfather. So Dan was trying to stifle his laughter throughout, as was I, and so feel free to laugh along at how ridiculous my voice sounds. Hope it doesn't put you off though, because Dan's insight is absolutely killer. So as mentioned, after the gig, which was awesome in Barcelona, we met up again for a few drinks for a couple of hours, and Christian was there, Liam's keyboardist, and he knew of Stage Left, which was cool, and he really liked the concept of what we did, and why it exists. And actually, later in the week, he sent me a text out of the blue, which was really nice, saying that his wife's charity, Brighter Sounds, his wife Kate does this amazing work, and we actually set up a phone call, and we're going to be actually looking into how we can actually work together, because there's quite a lot of overlap that Christian identified between what she does and the Stage Left podcast does. So I'm going to be going up there to meet them, and possibly record an episode with Christian as well, because he actually played with another guest on the Stage Left podcast, the legendary Steve Cropper. So he was telling me about that, and he's just a great guy, a funny guy. So watch this space about that. In the meantime, we've also had discussions about doing live versions of the Stage Left podcast at the Cool as Fuck Groucho Club in Soho. Quite a notorious, amazing place. Noel Gallagher's a member there. It's going to be great if that comes off. So they've approached us about doing some live ones, which is something that could be on the radar. So it'd be good to hear from people if you're based in London, if that's something you think you might want to attend. And yeah, that's going on at the moment. So I do this away from two other jobs. So if you do want to buy us a coffee or buy us a bottle of wine for us to drink while we're editing the next episode, that'd be fantastic. You can do that at stageleftpodcast.com. We were podcasting of the week, in Rob Watch's Movie Online, I think was the organization that did that. And they said some really amazing things actually, which was really, really nice of them. So thank you for that. And our next episode is with the Baby Shambles drummer, Adam Fychek, who used to be in a rhythm section with Drew McConnell, who we're going to be discussing in this episode, who does some incredible work with music and mind, so supporting musicians with addiction and mental health issues, and which we know is an under-resourced thing in the music industry and much needed. So this is going to be a really interesting episode. We're recording that in a couple of weeks. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Here we go. This is Dan McDougall.
So I signed a revolution from my bed, 'cause you said the brains I had went to my head. Step outside, the summertime's in bloom. Stand up beside the fireplace and take that look from off your face, 'cause you ain't ever gonna burn my heart out. Over to you.
Okay, welcome to a very special episode of the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Today we have a man who is exactly that, as our guest today facilitated the second coming of the force that is Liam Gallagher, not only collaborating in the studio but sat on the edge of the noise as live drummer and now backing vocalist for Manchester's Finest. Today we'll be discussing this man's development as songwriter and drummer, what the first rehearsals with Liam were like, the meteoric rise of the platinum record as you were, how to thrive when working with big personalities, whether Jane Mailer has taught him the splits, and how to prepare for high pressure shows such as this week, where our guest had to sing the most important line of Live Forever, fucking falsetto no less, to this year's biggest TV audience in the UK, the Brit Awards. So we recorded this in Barcelona hours before a sold out show tonight at the Razzmatazz, which we're totally psyched for. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Dan McDougall. Thanks for joining us today. Dan, how's it going?
Good, yeah. Yeah. A bit tired, but sprightly.
So you just arrived in from Madrid?
Yeah, just on the bus overnight. Just had a lovely shower in a dirty venue, and now I'm here.
Cool. Well, so that was the first night of the tour, is that right? Last night?
This leg of the tour. So the European tour that we're doing at the moment, which is about 2.5 weeks. So first show was last night. Pretty rowdy.
Was it, yeah?
You know.
How was, because I went to a lot of the early shows that you did, so... Brixton Electric and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Fucking brilliant. How has the band evolved? How has things evolved in the band in the last kind of 9 months?
It's definitely a far more well-oiled machine for now. Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, in this first shows, that was pretty nerve-wracking considering what was happening and who we were playing for, what was going on. But now it's kind of settled into just sort of, not easy, but just we know what we're doing and we just get on and try and smash it every night.
Yeah. Cool. So you're going to sound check later. What specifically are you looking for when you sound check? Is there a particular kind of setup that you particularly need? Do you have a click track? Like, what is it that you want from your sound check personally?
What we've got into this routine where I get on stage first, so I do my drum check, because it got to the point where we were all just sort of slamming out loud noises and no one could actually figure out what they were doing. Mm. So we have this routine now where I go on first, I check out what's going on with my kit and I kind of tweak it. And so I just want to make sure my drums sound as best as they can with my tech. And I'm quite anal with that. So I'll just play around with the snare for a good 5 minutes if I really have to. And then we get everyone else on and just make sure we can hear each other. Sometimes there'll be technical difficulties which you figure out. Sometimes Liam will be there, sometimes he won't. And if he's there, he might want to try something new or chuck something at us the last minute, which we're not expecting.
Such as what, a different song?
Just like a new song or like something we haven't played for ages, and then, you know, we just, okay, we'll figure that out. And it's fine, but, you know, he likes to throw a curveball every now and then.
And how do you choose set lists with such a body of work? Does he text it to you or how does that work?
Yeah, he usually texts it through. He'll try and keep it usually the same set for a tour. Just sometimes it just feels like doing something different. Usually he'll text it, or we'll just hear from the tour manager, it's the same as last night or whatever. Or we'll just find out as we walk on. Look at the sheet.
So the Brit Awards this week, When did you find out you're doing that? Because is it a case that it was quite a last minute thing?
2 days before.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you don't normally sing that line, do you?
No. So I didn't know that until the night before.
Right.
So, we found out 2 days before, we weren't told exactly what it was, just a bit of promo, it might be happening, are you free? It's like, yeah, I can make myself free, what is it? So I can't tell you right this second, because we don't know, it's confirmed. It's like, okay, was probably going to be the Brits.
Yeah.
Because that's what's coming up.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, we try to kind of set up with four backing vocalists. I think it might have been a Liam idea or a management idea. But it wasn't secure whether they'd actually be doing it or not. It was kind of a, just to check it in the room and see how it felt. And Liam just decided it wasn't right.
So you rehearsed this where?
In the O2.
Oh, right.
Like, yeah, we just rocked up on the sound check the day before. And he just felt like the audience should sing it. And quote, he's like, if they don't, well, they fucking should. And then he sort of, I think he sort of fell away from the idea of the BVs. And then I went sort of home that night. And then I got a text from the manager. It's like, do you reckon you could sing that line tomorrow? Like, I'm not even joking. I was like, yeah, okay, fine. Like, I have sung. Like, I do consider myself a bit of a singer anyway. So yeah. it was fine. But, I mean, definitely one of the most nerve-wracking things I've ever done.
Yeah, so were you just, like, practicing that line over and over all day?
Yeah, so there at me, like, backstage with Mike, the guitarist, and I was just, you know, humming it under my breath the whole time. He's like, will you shut up? Stop thinking about it.
Maybe I will never be all the things that I'd like to be. Now is not the time to cry. Now's the time to find out why. I think you're the same as me. We'll see things I'll never see. Really well. Next stop, Aquarius. The energy that man can create on stage, Liam, with those songs is absolutely fucking insane. Mm-hmm. What are your highlights so far? What are the gigs that are the ones that really stick out so far that you've played? Oh, fuck's sake.
Sorry, no, please.
It's okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, my voice is rough.
That's the one tour trick. Always put your Do Not Disturb on.
Yeah. we can add that in, yeah. yeah, so what were the particular gigs that have been highlights for you so far?
I mean, off the top of my head, I mean, One Love Manchester was pretty surreal.
So that was the day with Coldplay. You had to play Coldplay's.
Yeah.
You played the drums.
Yeah, and couldn't hear any drums in my...
Really?
Whatsoever. It was the worst sounding gig I've ever done. Yeah,
but out front, like, watching
it back, it's fine. But if you watch it, you'll see me screaming at the drum tech between right. two songs. Like, I can't hear any drums.
So you've flown in from Denmark,
Germany, right? Germany, yeah. So they'd moved the stage time in Germany, and again, that's another thing we found out like 2 days before that we were doing.
Yeah.
Moved the stage time in Germany. Forward or back, how you say it, like earlier.
Yeah.
And then walked straight off stage into some cars, private jet, landed in Manchester about an hour before the gig, sort of like screamed down the motorway.
Yeah.
Just it was like kind of like a pub gig. Here's a snare, just run on, sort of like move the kit around where you want it and off you go.
Really?
You've got 2 minutes to do it, by the way. Yeah. And then to sort of start a song and then couldn't hit any drums whatsoever was just like bonkers. So I just had to rip an ear out and just sort of blag it. Like, everyone was blagging it. Like, it was proper blag. But I think we did all right.
Yeah, it was great.
For the cause, anyway. The whole reason of doing it was great.
And did you know the kit? Like, did you, like, go and Google the Coldplay drummer's kit to, like, see what he said?
No. I mean, I'm...
Just hope he's not offended.
I'm a Coldplay fan anyway, so I kind
of...
Yeah,
of course.
I sort of knew what he would sort of have. But, I mean, it was, you know, I just had to sort of... I actually made a joke to the drummer, just like, can I borrow your kit, mate? Like, as I was walking on, and was like, yeah, of course you can.
Manchester vibes in the area! Rock and roll star!
Say, like, everyone says Reading was great, but actually as a band we thought Leeds was better, weirdly.
Right, why?
For some reason, there's just the vibe there was great and we played brilliantly. And just, I think it's because we did Leeds first out of the two and all the flares went off and all the kids are just going absolutely nuts that we got that sort of feel from that first gig and then sort of knew what was coming for the second one, maybe. I don't know, but yeah. What else was good? I mean, there's been some amazing ones. Just like some gigs feel good, some don't. Some people have a great gig in the band, some won't. Like we'll walk off and everyone's had a good one and I've been like, nah, that's a bad one for me. I'm like, oh, really? So I just wasn't feeling it.
So how many of the band did you know before?
Zero.
Really?
Yeah.
Right, and so you worked with Liam beforehand on actually writing, is that right?
No, right, just involved really heavily in the album process. So like, I helped him demo a load of things before.
Wow.
We actually started recording, so it's just me, him and an engineer just trying to get some stuff down because all his songs are in his head and just in a notebook, like no recordings whatsoever. So yeah, we did some recording with Dan Greck, the producer, first, and then they went, you know what, this is good, but we just want to hear the songs that Liam's got before we commit to, you know, paying a load of money. So they got me to just spend like a week just slamming them down like really, really quick.
Where was that?
Snap Studios, North London, which is actually where we did most of the album. So yeah. I spent a bit of time in there. And there was another studio, I can't remember, it was for a really small, somewhere in Hoxton. But yeah, that was like, it was just such a quick process and like kind of like one take of everything, just like slam it down quick. Just
was much of that kept on the album?
One track they actually used quite a lot, the parts we did on one of the original things, which is Never Wanna Be Like You, which is like the last tune on the deluxe thing. Yeah. So they just kind of took that and just reworked it with Dan Greck. But I mean, yeah, they were sort of just maps of the songs, and then we'd go into the studio and sort of redo it and make it sound a lot better.
So let's talk about your story. Your mum was a music teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was keyboardist.
Yeah.
Is that right, Tori? So obviously you were surrounded by music. Steve Jordan specifically was a drummer that you've said that you admired technically. How have you carried forward any of his drumming techniques or influences into your own drumming?
I think the approach of just playing for the song has always been a thing of mine. And I just love how sort of simplistic that guy is, but it still feels great whatever he does. And he can let rip if he really wants to, but it doesn't mean he has to. So I think that's sort of what I try and do. Like in the set, some there are spaces to kind of go a bit more mad, and there are others where you just got to lay it down and keep it solid. So just whatever's required. Yeah, especially in the studio as well. You just no messing around. Don't kind of get in the way of anyone else.
And what were your motivations at a young age around music? Like when you were say 12, 13.
I didn't really realise I was kind of wanting to be a musician until around that time, 13, 14. And that's since, I mean, I spoke to Liam about this, we were having dinner across the table and he was just like, what's your favourite album of all time, Dan? And I knew he wouldn't like this, but mine and his relationship is about me being honest usually, so I just said, it's the first Coldplay album.
Wow.
And he took my beer off me and announced at the table that I was too drunk and said, I think Dan's had too much to drink. He thinks the first Coldplay album is the best album ever made. And I was like, give me a minute to justify that point. And it was because when I first heard that stuff on the radio, considering I was 13 years old, something just kind of connected with whatever was going on. I didn't know why I liked it. But I saved up my pocket money and waited for the album to come out and just sat. Like, I remember my mum shopping around Marks and Spencer's and I got my little CD Walkman and just listened to the whole thing start to finish while she was just buying stuff. And that kind of made me want to be a songwriter, really. And then Liam put my beer back down and went, all right, fair enough. So, yeah.
And from a songwriter point of view, Guy Chambers was someone who you were influenced by as a songwriter?
Yeah, when I was a lot younger, because I used to look at sort of label sleeves and wonder what was going on once I figured out the songwriting was a thing. and just noticed his name on quite a few things, especially like all early Robbie Williams stuff, and just out of curiosity, and then kind of went, what's he doing, why does he do it, and just sort of became a bit intrigued by that whole thing. So yeah, he kind of set off that just by being on the label copy of like, what's that guy doing, and why am I interested? So I just switched that on to why can he be in the background. And
so what was your journey from writing songs at a young age to being signed as a songwriter to a record label?
Just sort of messing around in bands. So like I grew up being like punk rock and ska bands, and like the first band I was in really was a ska band called Dexter's Fish, where I was the singer and trumpet player.
Right.
And that kind of taught me, without even realising, what hooks were, just through like brass lines and you know, really catchy melodies. And so I think I didn't realise it, but I was sort of figuring that out quite early without realising, like how to get a hook into a song and everything. But then that just progressed into ended up going to Leeds College of Music and just spending about 3 years just trying to figure that out and thinking I was an artist, and then realising that I wasn't as well in that process. But I wanted to be that
Why?
Guy. I just don't have that ingrained thing of I need to shout to the world and tell them something, which I think a good artist kind of needs to have, like they have something to scream about. Whereas I'd just be on stage singing and just hate it. Like I just didn't have the passion for that for some reason.
Did you see yourself as a drummer at that stage? More as a songwriter?
Kind of both. That was my ideal. Like if I could be a session drummer and a songwriter, then I'd be winning. And
you're winning.
Luckily that's what I'm doing now. I didn't see it as like I am one thing. It's like I'm a musician, like primarily, because I play a bit of everything, and you know, like on that Liam record, it's like a bit of everything. To be honest, just whatever was needed.
What about getting signed?
So then that evolved through meeting management via Dan Grepp, actually, who produced the Liam album. I drummed on the first Tom O'Dell record and played with him for a while. And through Dan met my then management, and they took a good interest in what I had, basically a portfolio of songs that I've sort of been collecting up over the years, and they were into it, and then luckily there were a few acts that were sort of on the way up, like a good friend Bruno Major, we'd written a load of stuff and we went to uni together, and he was getting a lot of heat, and someone noticed that my name was against his name on the writing credits, and who's that? So then the publishers sort of started sniffing around and got a deal through that, really, and a few other things, like some pop cuts, and that kind of evolved into a deal.
Why were you specifically chosen to work with Liam, do you think?
It was because of the connection. So I've worked with Liam's management, half the management, UROC, for a long time, because they managed Tom O'Dell as well.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of got into it, and Dan Grepp being the same producer, and me and Dan have worked a lot together over the years, where I come in and be like the one man band, because he doesn't play anything, so if he's working with an artist, I'll come in and fill in the gaps. And then the management approached Dan and I and said, can you try some stuff out of Liam? I was just like, yeah, alright, this is interesting, but yeah, cool, okay. And I remember being in LA at the time doing on a writing trip, and I had to have a Skype conversation with Liam and Dan and the management, like, and they in some private room they'd got in the middle of London. Just like, it was well weird.
What was the point of that conversation?
Just have a discussion about how it would work, and I think Liam just wanted to meet us both and check, you know, suss us out. He doesn't really like strangers, so.
Well, yes, I mean, he's lent heavily on his brother, obviously, for many years, songwriting-wise. And then Gem and Andy in BDI. So it must have been unusual to work with a new person for the first time for him after all these years.
Yeah. I mean, he's a good judge of character, but he's also just, you know, he's in that life where he's got to be slightly on guard with everyone that he bumps into. So I think it was just to suss us out and make sure we weren't absolutely mental.
And what are your fondest memories of those first demos that you recorded?
I remember, like, me and Dan were sitting there waiting, just like for Liam to arrive, like just very curious about how it would go and, you know, will he hate it or... But he rocked up and just was just raring to go. Just like, right, what are we doing then? Let's go. And he was really up for it.
And did you lead that? Were you like a musical director or kind of thing, or were you, was that up to Dan?
Dan was in charge being the producer, but I mean, you sort of, because Dan's more, he's a producer role, but not really, he doesn't play anything. So yes, that's where I get like fill the gap. So I could talk to Liam about the musical side of things, or like whether that chord would be good there or whatever, or maybe we could play it different there or whatnot, or that sound would be a bit shit for this reason.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the things I remember from that session was him, we did two tunes which had sort of been previously demoed by someone else and kind of reproduced them. And then...
What were they? Can you remember?
I think it might have been Universal Gleam.
And Bold?
Bold, maybe. Yeah, I think Bold. And then there's something else. I can't remember now. It's all quite a blur because we did it so fast, most of it. But then there's one where he's like, right, I've got this tune, should I come teach it to you, Dan? Because like, I would play the acoustic because he can play guitar, yeah, and that's how he writes, but he'd rather, you know, I'd do it, like, just record it. And he took me into the live room and just sat there opposite me and just played me Greedy Soul.
Right.
Like, for the first time. And then that was the first time I sort of freaked out a bit and went, this is fucking mental. Just met this dude and he's playing me this tune that no one's ever heard before. And I've got to learn it and play it straight back.
And the drums, obviously, in that particular song are very, it's very definitely maybe kind of drum intro, like do do do.
Yeah.
Did you write that, or did you come up with that?
That was Liam. Just like, I want to do 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 do.
Cool.
Like he's very vocal with what he wants, and very opinionated in a good way.
Really, right?
Like he'll hear something instantly and go, hate it, or like try it. And then you try it once, and sometimes I can be like, I'm not sure what it'll be, but let's try it, and then. Yeah, me and Dan will be like, nah. He'll be like, yeah, cool. I totally respect your opinion. But yeah, he knows what he wants and how he wants it to feel. So yeah, that was him just saying, can you do something like that? So I was kind of focused on that. I've got a studio in London and, you know, I sort of work out of there. So I wasn't really intending on doing the live thing. Like, they did ask me to do it, and I was like, I'm not sure really, because I quit live to do the writing thing initially.
Oh, right.
So I hadn't been on tour for like 3 years.
Right.
And then they went away and auditioned a load of people and found some of the bands, and then came back and went, we still want you to do the drums, can you stop being a pussy? Essentially. And I was like, okay. Alright, I'll do it. It'll be good fun. I haven't been on tour for a while. So yeah, I mean, you know, some people are like, are you mental? You're saying no to this.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, alright, maybe I'm being a bit mental. So yeah, I'm so glad I did it though. It's been great.
How does it differ to what you expected it to be?
I think none of us expected it to be this good a crew, like as in the hangout and the band and everyone. We all get on like incredibly well. Like it's quite rare. I mean, the guys are a bit older than I am, so they've got a lot more experience than I do in sort of just bands and touring and everything. And they're just like, this just never happens. Like it's never this good.
Wow.
Yeah. So We've just got a great bunch of people. You know, partly down to Debbie as well. She's such a great judge of character, and she helped put the band together a bit. And you know, she chose. You know, she can read someone a mile off, so she just kind of helped build that and make sure there was no knobheads in sight, really, which is great.
And what are your memories of the first rehearsal? So, Drew, Jay, Christian, mm-hmm. as well, is that right?
Yeah.
Obviously, Mike. Yourself and Liam, and Mike, of course. What was the first rehearsal like? Did you rehearse yourselves before Liam was there? Or?
I didn't. I know Jay and Mike got together because, I mean, we started off learning all the Oasis stuff. That was the first. I had a 6-week block, and I think the first 2 weeks were dedicated just to the Oasis songs that they wanted to do. I know Mike and Jay spent a bit of time previously because they, you know, had to figure out who was going to do what solos and how to split the guitars up and figure parts out. But no, I rocked up. That was the first day I'd ever really played that stuff.
Wow. How many songs was it that you had to choose, like learn? Was it just the ones you played live, or did you do other ones? And
there were some other ones in there.
Keep it whatever.
Bring On Down.
Yeah.
What were the other ones? Listen Up.
Nice.
I Hope I Think I Know.
What did that sound like? That's never ever been played live, that song.
It was good. It was funny because like we'd learn it, and then Liam would come in, like I was saying, he's so opinionated, he'll hear it once and try and sing it once and go, nah, fuck it.
Yeah.
But I can't, no, I don't want to do that one. He was really quick about, no, actually that sounds mint. Well, that one sounds, or just like his voice is different these days. So some, you know, some of them we maybe change the key of, or like he just didn't feel like he wanted to sing it anymore. Yeah, like he's good. He just don't like it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Whose responsibility is it for things like particular samples? So like you know, the sample at the beginning of Be Here Now, mm-hmm. that starts it.
Yeah,
like. That, where's that been sat for 20 years? That song hasn't been played like live for 20 years. Obviously it's on the record, like how do you actually go about finding that?
We ripped that off a live YouTube video. We couldn't find it anywhere, so we had to go to some kind of radio session they did,
right?
So the quality is like horrendous. But this is the only place we could get it, so yeah, we just found that and looped it up, and it's on. I've got a little SPD pad thing, and I just trigger that off the beginning, just goes round and round.
In the band, or who's calling the shots?
I mean, we're not officially, but Mike's sort of fallen into that role. He's just so clued up on everything. He's a really smart individual, and just really good at it. He's just, so he'll kind of call which tunes we do in sound check and stuff, and then I guess me and him sort of deal with the Liam stuff. So like if he wants to change a tune, we'll sort of figure that out, or like he'll text directly and go, can you make sure, like Live Forever, he texted yesterday, can you sing on it again tonight? I was like, oh, yeah, okay, so you know, I'm singing on that forever now. Live on forever, Dan.
It's worse getting to get your man, so. Interestingly, a couple of years ago we did an episode with Danny Goffey, you know, from Supercross Drummers.
Yeah.
And he was in, I went to one of his rehearsals, and Drew was playing bass with him,
mm-hmm.
and bless him, like, I think it was a bit of a last minute thing, but they had to like restart songs a couple of times. Danny forgot the words. The drummer was like, it came in the wrong part and stuff. And the one guy holding it together was Drew. And sure. I remember thinking, that guy's fucking on it. This guy's. What's his qualities in the band?
He's the most chilled out dude ever. Like, to the point where he's like laying down. Like, the whole time. No, he's brilliant, man. He has no fear whatsoever. So he just like, he'll just walk on and do it and like, yeah, cool. And just nail it and then walk off
again. Really?
Like, yeah, he's brilliant.
Is it difficult locking into the rhythm section as a drummer, working with a bassist you'd never worked with before?
Yeah, it took. I mean, that's normal for everyone, I think. Just figuring out how each other works. Like, he said that I've got the latest snare in the world. Like, he's like, I keep waiting for your snare to come, and I'm like, so I think, I don't know, I didn't even know that quality about myself, if that's a good quality or not, but yeah, it definitely takes a while to sit in with each other,
yeah,
figure out how each other move around and everything.
And Jay, the guitarist, he apparently is an outstanding songwriter as well.
Mm.
Have you heard some of his songs?
Yeah,
because we did one with Gem, who's in BDI with him, or someone's in BDI. And he said that Jay once just recorded this piano song, like his piano ballad, if you like. It was absolutely outrageously good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, Gem was like, "What you can do with it?" He was like, "Nothing, just left it." And it just sat there. Like, he's just a really apparently amazing songwriter as well.
Yeah, he does it. He does it as a hobby, essentially.
Really,
in his words, yeah. He just loves doing it. As fact, he's got a little studio in his house, and he loves recording stuff and writing good lyrics. And constantly, like on the road, he'll just have like a drum pad and.
Mm.
Like a little iRig thing, like he's brought some stuff with him, just to sort of just mess around and keep himself busy, do something productive while he's away.
Yeah.
But yeah, he doesn't really. He'll play them to us, but like he doesn't ever see himself releasing anything. Like, he wouldn't call himself a songwriter, even though he is.
Really?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Like, he's like, nah, it's just my fun thing I do.
Wow.
Yeah. But I think he does want to do some recording at some point. Like, he's spoken about it.
Has he taught you the splits? Has he taught you the splits? He does the splits everywhere, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. No, he hasn't taught me. No. That's he hasn't done that in a while.
Wonder why.
he's done it a few times, but no, I can't do the splits. No, he can only do that after a few whiskeys.
Yeah, some good videos on the internet of that. For what it's worth, great tune. Do you play drums on the record on that?
Mm-hmm.
Because you change it in kind of the middle eight, don't you, now, the drums? You do, like, put this amazing extra feel, which isn't on the record.
No.
And it's like, when I'm listening to the record version, like, I play air drums, I was doing it to do King's Cross, I play the feel that you do on the live version, but it's not on the record anymore.
Why did you change it? Liam wanted it to, like, he wanted it to be a bit more floor tommy, like, sort of the vibe to be slightly different after we'd recorded it. That's the thing, like, once you do it in the studio and then you play things live, they develop into what they are. Like a live version, and Liam's quite into that, having a live version and a studio version,
right?
So like why Greedy Soul is like electric live acoustic on the record, just because he wants it to be more ballsy. And he'll change, like Live Forever's had about five different versions of who's playing what.
Yeah.
Like Drew's on 12 string now, and Mike's on electric making some weird noises that have never been there before.
Yeah,
he just kind of he'll just come on and go. He'll just go and sort of think in his own head what could be better, or what could be different, or how to just change it up a bit.
When he comes in, so you literally go and he comes in on the right key. How does he know what's the right key?
Because the guitarist just goes
perfect,
play chord just so he knows what to expect.
But how does he ever, like, does he do that? How it must, because I've seen you do it live, like you did it in like this strange little and like an acoustic version of it, like, in Europe somewhere.
Oh, and, yeah, that weird German thing,
yeah. And there's all these kind of guys
that was well,
like,
weird, that.
So weird. And the women at the bar who were the presenters were singing along and stuff like that.
Strange.
But like, yeah, so he just drums it and just. going live, bang, he goes straight into it.
Yeah, Mark will just do a chord. He'll just like just say Liam knows where he's sitting at. And then, but yeah, just straight off the bat.
And are there, might you be changing set lists any times? Like, do you know something called Let's All Make Believe?
What's it?
Let's All Make Believe.
No, I don't know.
Fucking brilliant. So get him on that. And okay. Round Our Way, have you ever rehearsed that?
No. Okay.
Oh, fucking hell, man. Plays a while if you play them once. What techniques do you employ when working with Liam to allow him to express his creativity in writing in the studio?
He's a nice dude anyway, so he'll say what he thinks. Like, that's who he is, isn't it? So, I mean, I think honesty is the key for someone like Liam. Like, he just, like, because he's sort of surrounded by bullshit quite a lot of the time.
Yeah.
If you actually tell him something straight up, he's a bit, puts him, not off guard, but sort of just gain a bit of respect out of the guy. So yeah, like one of the first things he ever asked me was like, which football team do you support? And I was like, I don't like football, mate. He went, fuck it out. Alright. Cool. I didn't bullshit him.
You know? Yeah.
I think that's why we get on. Just being honest, like you're saying straight up, like, maybe that could be better or you could do that differently. You know, like when we were doing the demos, I'd have to tell him to do a vocal take again.
Yeah.
Which is scary as fuck, you know. Like,
so how did you do it? Imagine I'm Liam, how, I thought I nailed a vocal. How would you do it?
So just give that one more pass, man. I reckon you can do that better. Or like, maybe try this. Maybe is one of the best words ever. It's like, maybe you could do this rather than going, you shouldn't do that. Maybe you could try this way. But I mean, yeah, it was so quick. But I mean, yeah, just give it another go, man. I reckon you're nearly there. Just can't quite. You're not quite hitting that high, but just give it another belt. Yeah, he's not a scary dude if you're just talking to the guy and working professionally. He's lovely.
And are there any other examples you've seen producers use to get the best out of someone's performance in the studio?
There's one story of my mate who was working with an artist and she couldn't get a vocal right. And he said, oh, have you not heard of the menthol technique? It's like, what menthol technique? Oh, go and have a menthol cigarette and it'll just like clear sinuses out and then you belt it and it'll be done. And so she went and had a menthol and then did like one take and it's perfect. And it's like, that was complete bullshit.
Excellent. Placebo effect.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I got a message on my phone from one of the alumni at Leeds College of Music.
Oh, yeah.
This is someone who... he's playing on a record that went number one in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I was interviewing you. And he said, I said, I was interviewing you. He said, oh, that's great. We both went to Leeds College of Music. Though we've never really hung out, we have a bunch of mutual friends. Anything I've gathered suggests he's extremely gifted. And that's John Woff, who's in the 1975.
Oh,
he's
right.
A saxophonist from the 1975.
Yes.
So tell us, I mean, Leeds College of Music has done some pretty amazing, had some pretty amazing results, if you like.
Yeah.
What are they doing so well there, do you think?
I think they're just trying to be a bit more forward thinking. So rather than kind of sit in the old lane of this is what you should learn because this is what everyone's done before us, I think they're kind of trying to figure out how to set you up to actually be a musician in the modern world, maybe, rather than knowing all your theory and your classical history and everything.
So what does that look like? So how does that differ? What is being set up in
the... I mean, it's changing all the time, but every time I go back, they sort of developed it a bit better. So, I mean, they focus more on sort of, you know, studio techniques and live kind of band performances, a bit of theory, which is obviously useful. And then you can sort of branch into different streams, so you can focus on production now, or songwriting, or like jazz or classical. I think you can streamline it a bit more than you used to. It's just a bit more of a modern approach, and having people come, like I'd go up and do little Q&A's there with my now buddy Danny, who runs one of the courses, and just talk about what I sort of do, just so the students can kind of get an idea of what actually happens in the real world. Because I was sat there once, you know, like confused about how I was going to be a musician, and then anything you do to help students get fired up is cool with me.
Yeah, cool. And from a songwriting point of view, now that you're working with someone with Liam, like Liam, do you feel that it changes your approach to songwriting at all? Because you think some of these songs could be used in a different version, be heard by loads of people. Like, we had someone on recently who writes for Beyonce, and he says the pressure of knowing this will definitely be heard by millions and millions of people is like, it does actually subconsciously change the way you approach writing. Now that you become, not, maybe not necessarily with Liam, but say when you were signed, mm-hmm. did that change your approach to songwriting, do you think?
No, I try to not let that affect me, because I think, you know, there are a few people out there who can meticulously write a hit because they know what that is, but I mean, that's such a mystery to 99% of everyone else. So, no, I always go on just instinct, whether I think something's good or not, and I don't know why I like it, but it I don't know, I just go with feeling rather than the thought most of the time.
What's your most memorable piece of sorry.
Fuck, you're doing well, man.
Like a Godfather. I'm glad you have come.
Show me your technique.
Yeah. What's the most important piece of memorabilia you've got? Music memorabilia.
I don't really collect that stuff. I mean, I've got all the passes from the Liam things we're doing.
Right.
So I'll have the One Love Manchester thing somewhere, which would be a good one for the grandkids.
Yeah,
I'm not really a hoarder. I don't really keep many things, to be honest.
Everything's recorded now on my Instagram and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've got like, you know, I keep the instruments I've got in my studio. Like, I've got the kit that's on Liam's album, the acoustic guitar, the bass that
nice.
I played. So that's all in my room. So, I mean, I could, you know, in 50 years ago, that's the bass that was used on that. Or whatever.
Yeah.
I guess that's kind of cool for the future.
What's the biggest thing that's gone wrong at a live show?
Luckily, we've been quiet. I mean, Liam was having a really bad gig once, and we weren't quite sure how to handle that, because it was the first time we've seen it.
And Chicago? So,
yeah. There's just a bad one. Like, he was just having a shit time, like, the monitors weren't right, and yeah, he was in a bad, but we hadn't really experienced that, so we didn't really know how to react to that. So sort of one of the songs went a bit whiffy because we were just so on edge, and something went a bit wrong. We pulled it back together, but it was like, whew, that was a close one. But now we know, if he's having a bad one, we know it's we know how to deal with it these days, so it's actually all right. Like,
and how do you deal with it?
Just carry on, just truck on. Like, he's not pissed off at us, he's just dealing with his own, you know, it's just his voice or something's frustrating him, whatever, you know. Like, if he's throwing his maracas at my drum kit, like, I'm just like, well, it's not me. It might feel like it.
What specifically do you do, advice from musicians to excel in high pressure environments? So, the Brit Awards this week, I know you rehearsed and stuff, but like, what do you do with that restlessness on the day of a gig, you know, if you've got a really, really high pressure gig?
Just try and keep yourself busy, I think. Like, there's nothing worse than waiting around for hours waiting for something to come. So I went into town, I just went into London and just kind of minced around with Mike whilst we were waiting. Went out a cup of tea, just looked some records. There's nothing worse than just sitting waiting for something big to happen.
Do you suffer from nerves? Not as much as I used to.
Like, when we first started doing the Liam shows, yeah, of course I was nervous because I wanted it to be good. But now I know it's fine. You know, you're just so far in knowing the material, and you got your brothers around you. You know, it's like you feel safe and secure and everything. So no, it's great. Even some of the huge shows, you just walk out and you're like, you know, I've got this. It's fine.
Nice. Yeah. It's a bit of a deep question, but who do you think you become on stage that you aren't off stage?
I don't know. Maybe a bit more professional. Off stage, I'm pretty non-professional. I don't know. I just try and enjoy myself, I guess. Yeah. So just like, as long as I'm feeling like I'm having a good time, then I guess I'm a happy person on stage. I don't know. I wouldn't say I'm not that good with attention, so I wouldn't say I'm kind of like loving the attention, but there's definitely a kick out of playing in front of 1,000 people.
So, yeah, I mean, is it affecting you in any way, being recognised and stuff like that now? Like, yeah, that must be a strange thing to happen.
Yeah, I don't really like it very much, which is kind of, I only get recognised very mildly, like hardly at all, to be honest.
Yeah.
Which is good for me. I've never really wanted the fame thing, like, as a face, you know. I'd rather be the credit on the sleeve, but it's all right. There's some nice people out there, and some mad ones as well. And the stone you throw will turn back in its path. One day you'll shatter like a wall of glass. A wall of glass. Like a wall of glass. A couple of people managed to get on stage in, where was it? Indonesia. She played recently. The security were awful.
Really?
Yeah, and some guy just got up and just like jumped on Liam, and it took him a good like 15-20 seconds to realise, and we're just like, I was about to get off the kit, and like, we're all just ready to put our instruments down and get, luckily he was just wanting a hug.
Right.
I mean, he could have, you know, it could have been anyone.
Yeah.
And then a second person got up about a minute later.
Oh, shit.
Like, what the, come on guys.
Other than that, I've been alright. I mean, Drew's been covered in a load of piss before. Which is quite funny.
Well, I mean, someone's thrown it.
Yeah, one of the arena shows is just like just drenched and just looked at me. It's like, oh, come on.
Bullseye.
Christian, the keys player, got hit with a perfume bottle in the hand.
Really?
Playing keys, and this glass thing went off his knuckle.
Like, ah.
Luckily, it was alright, but that, you know, what are you doing? Why are you throwing hard objects at the band?
Yeah. So let's talk about recording at home. What's your favourite kind of program or software that you use for?
So I'm a Logic guy. Yeah.
Same.
Just by default, because that was the cheapest and easiest thing to get hold of at the time when I was at uni. So yeah, but I love it. It's good. I just know how to use it.
What's your views on the Apple Loops?
I don't use them.
No,
I don't even download that folder.
Really?
Yeah, don't bother.
Yeah. So do you use any sample, like, where do you get your samples from, or is that secret?
No, it's not secret. I use a lot of That Sound. There's a company called I Want That Sound, which is a drummer and a producer who have created these brilliant sort of packs, and they go to other drummers now as well. So like the drummer from Mute Math, they've got a sample pack from him, and a guy called Aaron Sterling who does a lot of home recording, and he's was John Mayer's drummer for a while,
right?
So yeah, just if you want some vibey sort of live sound stuff, I use those. And I've just got a folder full of like random stuff. I just sort of root through and find different pieces, bits and pieces.
Electronic drums. Do you think they'll replace acoustic kits?
No, never. Never.
Do you play an electronic kit at any point at home?
My dad used to work for Roland, so I ended up trying some of those kits out when they first sort of started appearing.
Yeah,
and just they're just completely different. They didn't feel anywhere near the same to me. They have their uses. They are their own things. Like saying, you know, electric guitars will replace acoustic guitars. Like, this just won't happen. They're two different things, aren't they? So they're completely different.
He's hoping. What bad habits do you have that you would teach a young musician not to do?
So my drum technique is non-existent. So I can't even do a double stroke roll. So the people who know what that means.
Really?
Yeah, I'm awful. But I've just sort of manoeuvred my way around it somehow. So I'm sort of mostly self-taught in the drums, really, just from playing to records. I got shown some technique, but I didn't really like practicing that, so I just didn't bother. I mean, I'd probably be a lot better if I had done.
Yeah.
So I'd probably say if you're a drummer, then maybe just learn that technique even if you don't really want to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it'll be useful. Like for me, I just can't. I'm sort of so past it. I don't really.
Has your technique evolved playing those songs? Do you think at all?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I've got a lot more calluses than I used to have.
The reason I ask that is the drummer in my band, Messina Isis and Liam and different guys for years, and he came to the Ali Pali gig,
yeah.
And he said those songs were realised because you hit the drums harder physically than any other person who's played those songs.
Yeah, I think that's true, yeah.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's really beefed it up, like it's a really fucking beefy sound that the whole band's got.
I've always been a pretty hard hitter, to be honest. Like, one of the first bands I was in called Kids Cosmic, like a three-piece sort of policey, right. Scary punk sort of thing, and that was just like slamming the shit out of them as fast as possible. Yeah. That's kind of where my thing came from. There's a band called the RX Bandits, and there's a drummer called Chris Sigarkis, and that's basically who I wanted to be when I was a teenager.
Mm.
So if you ever listen to that, you're kind of, that's where I just hard hitting, fast kind of punk rocky stuff.
We did the acoustic shows recently, and you've been playing Brushes.
Yeah,
obviously on them. Is that, do you have to rewrite your part completely if you like, or are you just blagging it? Like, do you have to rehearse that?
We've done a bit of rehearsals, but it's just a kind of just a slight blag, really.
The one you did on the rooftop was fucking.
Oh yeah, yes, that was freezing cold.
Was it?
Yeah,
because you're wearing a hat. And, like,
I don't know who.
It was outdoors.
Yeah, who comes up with these ideas? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Some might say it sounded so good. Yeah, it was great. Do you do anything to like warm up, like to avoid injuries and stuff like that?
No.
Watch out for the tendonitis.
I've never suffered from anything ever in my whole life like that. I mean, hopefully, you know, if I can touch.
Yeah.
But I'll stretch my wrists and stretch my arms before I go on, but I don't have a pair of sticks, like, you know, doing the rudiments that I can't play those days.
Yeah.
So no, I sort of rock it. I mean, the first couple of tunes, sometimes you feel a bit stiff, but I just know my body, and I'm like, that'll just ease off once we get to like the third song in. Quite a unique character, so I mean, what have I learned from Liam? I've learned to sort of try and worry less, so not musically speaking, but like, I'm intrigued by how, I mean, you know, obviously he's a human, but he tends to appear to not give a shit, which I admire in a way. Which I've spoken to him about it before, and he's just like, this is too much time in the world to worry, so why bother? Not enough time in the world. I don't know. Just how to be that famous and still be yourself is quite an interesting thing that comes from him, which is not what a lot of people can do, really. Like, have that level of recognition and still remain the guy you were when you're a kid, which is his whole outlook on life really, is just don't change.
Yeah.
Be yourself, and that's who he is. Like, this is who I am. Don't like it, then go away.
What don't we see of Liam off stage?
He is who he is. You don't really. That's kind of the guy. I mean, he's just a bit. You'll see him smile a lot more backstage. You know, have a giggle. But that's about it, really. He's the same guy, and he has the same anecdotes that you'll see in interviews, and he's the same dude, really. Yeah.
What about self belief? Like, he's got me. He's the most confident seeming and self belief like I've ever encountered or seen on stage. Is that real?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he's proud of who he is.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what comes across, really. Some people call that ego, but I think it's just, it's an essence of that, but it's just being proud of who he is more than anything.
I met him a few years ago, and I had like a CD in my band.
Yeah.
So I was very young at the time, and I was like, oh, Liam, you listen to my band, it's a CD. And he's like, oh, it looks like rain. And I was like, yeah, I'm influenced by you and that kind of stuff. And he kind of looked at it and he went, you're influenced by us. I was like, yeah. And he went, why don't you change the fucking world then? Bang down. Like, true, why was I changing the fucking world? Yeah, what a fucking legend. One really surprising thing that you did at a live gig, Glastonbury, Don't Back in Anger.
Oh, yeah.
What are your memories of, did you have to rehearse for that? I know you just did the shakers and stuff, but like, when did you find out you're doing that?
We had a rehearsal just before, maybe a few days before or something. And it was that was a secret as well, to the point where he didn't tell the band. Sort of, we didn't really know what was happening. I sort of just got called in, like, well, we got told to get out of the room, go have lunch. And then I got called down, like, Liam just wants to speak to you. And then he said, right, we're going to do this, and it's just going to be me and you. So, okay, cool, man. So, yeah, we just practiced it, and then, yeah, the band found out. But, I mean, he just didn't want anyone to even be able to let that out or let anyone know that was happening. So just to really get the essence of surprise.
And it was. I mean, I was sitting in the crowd, and I remember specifically going, like, joy.
He's doing it.
Like, fuck,
oh, God,
hell.
He's doing it.
Yeah, totally crazy.
Yeah.
Now you've got to a level you wanted perhaps to achieve at a young age. Mm-hmm. What's your motivation now?
Just to keep on doing it. You know, it's such a fickle game, this sort of music thing. So anything to just keep playing music and be able to do, you know, make a living from it is fine by me. Just stay professional, stay cool.
What about your writing? What about writing? Would you want some of those songs to be materialised with other musicians or?
Yeah, that's still happening in the background. I mean, I'm not at home as much as I used to be, but I'm still writing a lot. When I am back, still got my studio that I sort of work out of and work with artists and.
Are you contracted to write a certain amount of songs per year?
No, that's entirely up to me.
Really?
How I work, yeah.
And then when you're writing, do you have a particular artist in mind, or whose voice is singing the songs? Is it your voice?
I always write with the artist directly, usually.
Right.
Yeah. So they'll come to my studio for a day or two.
Yeah.
And you sort of write with them and figure out what they want out of this situation.
Yeah.
I do a lot less. I don't really do that pitching thing, really.
Right.
Like where you write for someone, because that's just that's like winning the lottery, that sort of world.
When you've collaborated with someone and you've asked them what they want, have you ever been really put in outside your comfort zone?
Yeah. I quite like that, though.
Right.
Yeah, there's a girl called Iris Gold who's a bit sort of hip hop. And I've never written a hip hop tune before. She's a rapper, but sort of sung choruses, sort of style. So I was like, well, how can I kind of make this hip hop but still like musical, or what I would do? So we sort of created this hip hop tune with me just sort of cutting up some old loops and beats and things and trying to figure out how that worked.
Yeah.
And then just put some hooks in it, and she rapped some brilliant lyrics and sort of weird and wonderful sort of imagery. So that was really enjoyable, and we wrote loads of stuff in the end. But that was like a very strange collaboration, which I didn't think it worked. But I hear kind of artists in whatever genre it's in, if it's something interesting, then I'll latch onto it. So I quite like the idea of taking a genre you don't know,
yeah,
and then making your own thing out of it, which creates something original. So, yeah, that was one of the most difficult ones I did, but it just worked for some reason.
What's the biggest setback in your career you had, and how did you approach overcoming it?
I mean, there are times at university where I'd sort of, you'd have like industry people come up and you'd play them something you're really proud of and they'd just like brush it aside like,
really,
it was rubbish. And looking back, that it probably was.
All right.
But at the time, you're so invested in that song that you put your heart and soul into and then someone just shoots it down. And that's why what I try and tell other young people is that they're not there to push you back, they're just there because it needs to be better. Like, you can't just kind of blag your way through, it has to be amazing. And they're not like wishing you to not succeed either. I'm telling you this is bad because it is.
Yeah.
I'm not just saying it because I don't want you to be good. Which is, that was a huge lesson I learned while I was sort of studying and figuring that out. Like, why they just hate now, they don't understand.
Yeah.
This song's amazing. And then, like, you know, I listen back to what I did 10 years ago and like, yeah, crap.
yeah. And what do you think about the science of songwriting in regards to, do you ever try and follow a particular style, not style, but chord progressions and stuff like that? Or is it just all feel, wherever feels next?
Yeah, it can be feel, or just if they've got a certain style that uses, you know, certain chord progressions, or, you know, either use, like, some people won't want any, you know, like, magical chords or anything, I guess would be the word, but, like, you know, just really straight up triad-y kind of,
yeah.
Some people are into that, like, some people hate major sevens, you know, they're like, oh, it sounds a bit jazzy, but then other people just love all that stuff. It depends. You know, your palette is different depending on what the artist wants or who they are. So I take that into consideration when I'm listening to what they're doing or who they're influenced by, and I'll kind of quickly pick up on, okay, they're into that kind of cool thing, or they love that style, or, and then kind of plug that into something new.
And you mentioned Guy Chambers being an influence. Do you work with him?
Yeah, I've actually worked with him. I've met him a couple of times. Yes, I did. I wrote a couple of songs with him and my mate Bruno Major, I mentioned, yeah. That was years ago. So yeah, that was a big deal for me when that came up.
So tell us about that.
So I was writing a lot with Bruno and he'd just been signed. And then the option came up to write for Guy wanted to work with Bruno, and they're like, well, can we get Dan involved? And, you know, because they work together a lot.
Yeah.
And also, I just wanted to meet the guy and see what was going on. And yeah, went to his amazing studio, which was then in Primrose Hill. Just hung out for a few days and just wrote some stuff. None of which got used in the end, really. But it was just interesting to see the guy. He's got so much gear.
Yeah.
Like, just toys everywhere. It was interesting.
Did you ever get writer's block, and if so, where, you know, if the well is empty, where do you go to for songwriting?
I don't really get writer's block as such. I get, because I have this technique where I just get the artist to play me a load of stuff that either they've just written that they're really into,
yeah,
and also new stuff that they're listening to, so that I can kind of tap into what they like.
Yeah.
And usually that'll set my brain going when I hear a load of stuff that I've never heard before.
Okay.
So that's the technique I use, just new music. And so that kind of just leads me down a path and then off we go.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't really write on my own, to be honest. I just love collaboration is my thing. It's just a lot more fun.
Cool. What's the price you pay for doing this job working in the music industry? What are the pressures we don't see?
Lack of sleep. Be a big one. Like, trying to sleep on a moving vehicle is not always the best scenario for getting a good night's sleep. I don't have family, a lot of the other guys do, so that's really tough if you're away all the time, yeah. And not seeing your kids and your wife and or your husband or whoever. It's quite an emotional whirlwind sometimes as well. Like, some people deal with, you know, you get depression every now and then, or like some people, you know, addiction and all that kind of thing. Not really in our team, but you know, I've seen, everyone knows a lot of people who've gone through that.
Yeah.
So that can be a toll. It's just it's the waiting game, isn't it? So there's a lot of waiting around sometimes if you're on tour. And so some people just turn to something else to keep themselves busy. I quite enjoy not being home at the moment, so I quite like just being away and not having a base. And seeing the world's great, so that's the good part of it.
Yeah, traveling is incredible. How will you look back in 30 years on this specific period of your career?
That it was a good decision. I'm so glad I said yes to doing this now, and it's evolved into something a bit more than just a job, like it's kind of friends for life sort of scenario going on.
Mm.
It's brilliant. Yeah, it's loving it.
Reflecting back, how did it pan out differently to what you expected? The music industry, your career so far. So when you were 12, 13 and first picking up instruments, how does it differ?
I thought I was going to be in a punk rock band and like tour the world in a van, which I definitely wanted for a long time. I think it's probably differed in that I think I prefer the luxury of what we're doing now, which is, you know, we're very lucky that you get treated well. I don't think you can forward plan too much with this sort of world, this sort of musician thing. You just kind of take what comes, and it's always going to be, I could be doing something completely different in a few years, maybe, you never know. I don't think I expected anything. I just knew I wanted to be a musician, and if I could do that, then brilliant.
Proudest moments? I know you kind of mentioned the One Love gig and stuff like that, but any others away from Liam, or any other proudest moments, or the ones you'll tell your grandchildren?
Signing the first, my publishing deal was a big one, because that was kind of what I set out to do from a young age. I didn't know why I wanted a publishing deal or what it was really, but that's what songwriters have got, I want one. And
that's interesting to talk about Jay earlier. He's happy to have that as a hobby. Mm-hmm. But was that like for the kudos, or did you feel that was what achievement looked like?
Yeah, I thought like having a publishing deal meant I could be a songwriter full time, which is was the dream.
Yeah.
And then I got one, and it was like, oh, cool. So now I have some money and I can songwrite all the time. So yeah, a bit that felt so far away when I was younger. It's like, I don't even know, you know, who do you talk to? Who do you knock on the door of? It's just, yeah, it seems so far to get to that point. When now I'm sort of here, it's like, well, I have been working my ass off for 17, 18 years. So it's not like it just happened overnight. That is still like half of my life or more than trying to get to this point, which some people don't realise, I think. It's like, you know, you don't just kind of rock up to a Liam Gallagher audition and go, oh, nailed it, here we go.
Yeah.
It's like, no, there's been 18 years of effort to get the skills to do it. And, you know, it's more than drumming sometimes, it's just hanging out, or like, people skills. It's more the job, really. 5% of your time is spent playing a gig when you're touring. 95% is hanging out.
That's true. What advice would you give yourself, if you could, looking back?
Don't be offended by, like, going back to that earlier point of like thinking that that song was great. Like, don't be so disheartened by someone telling you that something's bad or you can work on it. I think I'd tell people, like, just don't be offended, because there'll be a lot of people saying no, like, along the way, and you'll lose jobs and you won't win that audition, or that song won't get cut, or just take it on the chin. So I'm really good at just like, oh, it didn't happen, cool, whatever.
Yeah.
That's part of the process, really. Yeah, just take it on the chin and keep working harder.
Interesting. You said about how Liam, like, kind of taught you a little bit that, you know, not to care so much about stuff, and, you know, it's interesting. What challenges exist today for young musicians that didn't exist when you started?
The whole online online music scene now is completely different. You know, like MySpace existed when I was coming through the ranks. But I mean, yeah, it's just a completely different world where you can actually be your own label now, or be your own sort of boss, just from the internet. Like the guy again, Bruno Major, who I mentioned, he had a record deal and made an album, got dropped, but didn't give up and just figured out how to do it on his own. Ended up basically producing his own album with a mate, and released it through Artists Without a Label, so he gets a huge cut of everything. It's just an administrative thing, and goes through Spotify and makes good money now, and he's working up the ladder now, and he's the main support on the Sam Smith Arena Tour.
Right.
He just played James Corden in the States, and it's all off his own back, really.
Wow.
Like, he's got, you know, management and a band and himself. And wow. That's about it.
Yeah. Cutting a lot out there, right?
So yeah, like he's sort of, and he's a big face for Apple Music and Spotify. They're really into him because he's sort of proving that that method is working.
Yeah.
So you can do it these days, and I think young kids just sort of need to grab hold of that. It's so easy. You don't have to pay really anything anymore to get your music heard if you really want it to be heard.
And that brings me on to one of the questions we always ask guests here, is what fears you have for the music industry and how might they be addressed?
As a songwriter, I get a lot of fear because you don't get paid for a start to be a songwriter unless you know you get your publishing deal and you get your royalties, but day to day you don't get paid to go and sit in a room and write a song with someone. And the fact that like the digital thing is really raping songwriters at the moment. It's getting better, apparently, so I'm told. But yeah, like the royalty checks they get are just a pittance sometimes compared to what like the artist side might get, because the cut's so low for a songwriter. Mm. If you're the artist, you get a lot more out of it. So for me, it's, yeah, there's fear in that, but I mean, it's got to change, because otherwise songwriters won't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there must be something coming.
How might it change? What does that change look like?
I don't know where the change will be, but just that the splits get sort of more evenly divided in the digital side of things. And more people need to sort of sign up to these online sites, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I'm not really sort of that in that world. I just let my manager sort of figure that out for me.
Yeah.
I just know the songwriters aren't really getting a good share. I mean, there is money to be had, but it's not brilliant.
And there's a risk then, I guess, that if they're not getting so much share, they might compromise what it is their output to try and get make it more commercial.
Like a singles market now. It's like the album's kind of dying a death. Even though they do exist, they don't really.
Yeah.
People will be writing only singles, only sort of hits, or trying to. So yeah, it's definitely changed the outlook of the writing game for sure.
Will there be a second album?
Yeah.
Are you working on it yet, or has something been written?
It's not started yet, but I mean they're starting to think about something happening soon. I don't know. There's no plan whatsoever. He's got to write it first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plenty of time to do that. Loads of gigs coming up. So.
Yeah. I think he's announced. I think people know he's going to the States to work with Greg Kurstin a bit again.
Yeah.
Start the writing again with him and Andrew Wyatt.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's as far as it's got. I'm still busy touring for the rest of the year.
Cool. What are your classic stories for touring? What are the funniest moments of Liam and the last year or so?
There was the one Love Manchester concert. This isn't actually a Liam story, this is a Christian story, which we love to talk about all the time. So he came along for the ride because he's the keys player in the band, but there was no room for the keys to be there.
Right.
So he just came on the private jet for the laugh.
Yeah.
So he got a bit boozed up, beside the stage, and we all sort of walked off and came out the back. And I stood there with Liam, Christian and me, and then Katy Perry walks past with her entourage and comes running over to Liam like, "Oh my god, thank you so much for coming and doing the One Love thing, you know, the last remaining rock star. Like, can we get a photo?" And Christian just butts in and goes, "All right, love, come on then, come on." He puts his arm around her. "I want a photo, madam, do you?" So he just puts his arm around her. And then she's like, "Oh my God, do something crazy, like put me in a headlock." And he goes, "All right." Just like yanks her head down, like, and gives her like a noogie.
Yeah.
And all the cameras are going, really? And like, Leo's just like trying to hold it in and just like has to walk off because it's cracking up. And we're just like, "Oh my God." And then he lets go and goes, "All right, off, clear off." And turns around to us and goes, "Who was that?"
Really?
"Is that Miley Cyrus or something?" Oh, Roger Daltrey came to one of the shows. That was a bit weird.
Yeah.
Where
was that?
In Brighton.
Yeah.
And I came off and I just saw Liam talking to this old dude. And I was like, "Who's that old dude?" Oh, I don't know. Anyway. Then we went back on for the encore. And then I found out apparently Roger Daltrey was just like, "That rock and roll sign you've got there, you need to get rid of roll. Not very roll, is it?" And he was like, "All right, chill out, mate." Apparently, yeah, just having a bit of an argument about who... You know, "Oh, fuck off." Like, "Who are you?" "I'm Roger Daltrey." "Well, I'm Liam Gallagher."
Really?
Yeah, I don't know how to say. But it just, apparently it was quite funny. There was one, I think there was one way, I wasn't there, but he went and watched the Foo Fighters at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And then they kind of found out that Liam was coming to see him, and they were excited. And he went straight over to Taylor Hawkins and went, "Oh, your band, mate, I really love that tune you've got."
Yeah. Whatever.
And then turned to Dave, went, "It was alright." And walked off.
Brilliant. Does it bother you, like, when you so didn't Dave Grohl like, and like, people like Beckham and stuff like that were watching your Glastonbury show? That must be so fucking weird.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It must get in your head a little bit. Like,
well, I suppose, like, Teen Spirit was one of the first tunes I ever learnt on drums.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was definitely a weird one. Bit of a freak out.
Yeah.
Like, I've had, yeah, Chad Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, just, yeah, I'd sort of learned sort of drumming from some of that old Chili Pepper stuff.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah, there's been some strange moments.
Because you know they're probably watching you, as drummers, like,
yeah.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's scary, man. It's just like, corner of my eyes, like Dave Grohl, oh God, don't fuck up.
And you didn't.
No, I mean, yeah, you just got to crack on, but I mean, there's still that thing in the back of my head, like, holy shit.
Yeah. Cool. All right, well, thank you so much for appearing on the Stage Left podcast. Thanks for the part you played in the comeback. Have a great... Keep up the good work. Sorry about the voice. Try to convince LG to do Let's All Make Believe at some point.
Okay.
Play well tonight, and we look forward to seeing you at the show, and thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you. Cheers, man.
So that was Dan McDougall, and this is my voice a couple of weeks later. I'm recovered now, thankfully. And it was really nice, I found, in that interview how he painted a picture of kind of how reflective Liam is when he's really kind of really considerate about set list choices and improvements and tweaks to the live shows, which is really evident because the show has evolved, having seen kind of one of the first ones that they did as the band to a couple of weeks ago in Barcelona. You know, 9 months on, you know, those tweaks he's made has really, really, helped the show. So that's great. Dan's a great guy, has a huge future. You know, I think he's going to be doing some amazing things in the music industry for a long time. So if you like that episode, you might enjoy other ones that we mentioned earlier with Gem, Russ, Mikey, Paul Gallagher. And as I say, Christian Liam's keyboardist is coming up as well. If you want to donate and, you know, buy us a beer or buy us a coffee or buy us a bottle of wine, you can do that at stageleftpodcast.com. We'd love you for that. We'll give you a shout out. Thank you. Yeah, please say hi and give us feedback, etc., at the stageleftpodcast.com or on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/stageleftpodcast, and our Twitter is at the Stage Left Pod. Go on the Instagram page as well, loads of good fun photos on there. So see you next month with Adam from Baby Shambles.